Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Today, we turn our attention to the influence that nature and naturally inspired design is having on the industry, from architecture to fashion and engineering.
By learning from the way that ecosystems work, applying the same principles to a building or an industry or even a city, it forces you to be very inventive with the whole idea of waste.
We talk to a few of the clever souls helping it happen and ask how design informed by nature, biomimicry as it's known, is making an impression in the world of sportswear.
Plus,
the architecture and the urban design of this place were a little bit ahead of the time in the 60s. The people are meeting them again. They appreciate them very much. It makes sense today much more than it did in the 60s.
Monocle's Rome correspondent David Pleasant brings us a report from the Italian capital's Olympic Village, a modernist complex built for the 1960 Games, which is undergoing a renaissance.
All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Naturally, the world around us has long been a source of inspiration to artists and designers, from the swirling leafy insignias of Art Nouveau architecture to understanding the properties and materials we use to create the fabric of our clothing. But there's also a burgeoning field of research applying these natural principles to solving sticky problems in the design industry. What can engineers glean from the strength of silk in a spider's web or the structure of a honeycomb?
Petra Gruber is an architect who works at the Biomimicry Research Innovation Centre at the University of Akron in Ohio. She also runs TransArc, a firm that works across disciplines on biomimetic design projects. We asked her to explain some of the concepts behind her work.
There is a variety of terms. So biomimicry is just one of the terms that are used for a strategic approach to learn from nature. So what we try to do is we investigate solutions from nature, and we try to transfer those solutions into a technological context. So this could be electronics, that's where it started. It could be, I don't know, medical engineering, but it could also be architectural design or any other kind of technological transfer. This has started ages ago when people started to use technology of any kind, but as a strategic approach, it has been present since, I would say, the 1960s. So this was when the terms were coined, and in German this was called bionic, in English it was called biomimetics, and I would say biomimicry is a more recent term that also includes sustainability into the methodology, and that's the only kind of major differentiation that I would see. So people talking about biomimetics talk about it more in the sense of a pure method to gather innovation, whatever that may be, whereas biomimicry includes an interest into sustainability and ecological design as well. So everything started off in the 1960s, I would say, and became very prominent in the 1970s, and then it got more loose and lost in a way. And I think the recent interest comes with a notion of ecological problems like climate change. So we have a lot of problems that we have to work on. We seem to be at a loss with our current technology. So what we are doing now is we look at the only other example that we have, and this is kind of biological design, is a design that has been created in a process of evolution and natural selection. And this is kind of the only alternative to our human man-made technology that we have. And in this way, I think it makes perfect sense.
Petra Gruber there of the Biomimicry Research Innovation Centre at the University of Akron, Ohio, shedding a little sunlight on what the natural world can teach designers. Architecture may seem like a discipline preoccupied with sheltering us from the elements, but the built environment can also stand to learn a few lessons from the natural world.
To find out how architecture is taking inspiration from nature, I spoke to two architects leading the charge. Doris Sung runs her own practice, Dosu, in California. Michael Paulin is founder of Exploration Architecture, based here in the UK, and has lectured widely on biomimicry.
Architects have been referring to nature for a long time, and I learned a certain amount about biomimicry as a student, but then it tended to be the same old suspects of, you know, termite mounds and spiders' webs. And actually, when I found out more about it, I realized that it was an amazingly diverse source of solutions for many of the really key challenges that we face today.
Doris, how about you? What was your route into biomimicry?
I think it started pretty far back for me when I was in school, and I didn't think it was biomimicry at that time, but I just simply asked the question, why couldn't building skins breathe similar to animal skins or plant skins, and why everything was designed to be more capsule-like and seal from the environment? And so that was one of my first questions when I entered architecture and kind of stuck with me throughout.
Now, as you've mentioned, you both have your own architectural and design practices. I wonder, in terms of what you're working on at the moment, how is nature and biomimicry influencing that work? Shall I begin with you, Michael?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things we're working on at the moment is a zero-waste textiles factory for a client in India. And textile factories use huge quantities of energy and water and produce quite a bit of waste. And by learning from the way that ecosystems work in very densely interconnected and interdependent cycles, in which anything that's waste becomes an opportunity for something to turn it into a lifestyle, applying the same principles to a building or an industry or even a city, it forces you to be very inventive with the whole idea of waste. And you can move towards a system that is pretty close to zero waste. It runs entirely on solar energy and is actually much more productive and much more efficient.
And Doris, what are you working on at the moment that is influenced by nature and biomimicry?
I guess there's two different parts. One of them is just looking at the variations in skin and skin cells and scales, like on a fish, things like that, and how we can differentiate a building facade using that kind of shape changing by computation, and then the operation of it, why they would actually peel open and ventilate out and do things like that. The other thing that we're working on, which I think is probably along the same lines too, is rather than looking at animal skins where they're mostly taking care of the body itself and the internal organs, is trying to look at things like plants, where plants not only take care of themselves, but they also give off and contribute to the environment. And so what we're working on now is trying to make systems where architecture can actually be a steward for the environment and actually do things like filter air, increase breeze so that it can cool down outside pedestrian space, so that it's not only taking care of people on the inside of the building, but it's also contributing to public welfare. In both plant and animal dynamics, we're looking at those things for influence.
Do you think, both of you, that there is a particular biomimetic aesthetic, or do you think that it's an approach that can accommodate a wide range of aesthetics? Maybe Michael?
Well, there can be, but there doesn't have to be, because actually it's a functional discipline. So it's not really about the way things look in nature, it's about the way things work. So for instance, in our biomimetic office building, one of the really big challenges was how we would gather and distribute natural light and bring it into the building to reduce the amount of artificial light we needed. And we looked at a lot of examples in biology of how light is gathered and distributed. And one of the ones that was really formative was a fish called a spookfish, which has amazing mirror-shaped structures in its eyes. And that led to the idea of a large-scale reflector, a mirror in the atrium. And underneath that, we created a meeting room. So that large mirror was bouncing light deep into the lower parts of the building. And it didn't look particularly biological, but the source of the idea was a biological solution.
And Doris, do you think as a designer and as an architect that your inclination towards biomimicry has affected your aesthetic, has affected what you think looks good?
That's a good question. I think the aesthetic and the results of it are more accidental than intentional. And I think a lot of it is because the material that I work in, which is a thermal bimetal, curls automatically and relative to changes in heat. And as it does so, because of the geometries that we use, they can all curl individually and at different times. And so when it reacts to the sun, it actually looks like it's alive, even though it's completely inorganic material. And I think that is kind of a side result, something that we did not necessarily intend. And as a result of that, working with the material more and more, we have to kind of control that kind of behavior in a very weird way, in some ways, pretend like the material is alive and treat it as if it's alive. And I think as a result, looks like it is in the end.
Doris Sun of Dosu Architecture Practice in California and Michael Paulin of the UK-based Exploration Architecture there.
Still to come, we look at a research project at MIT bringing athletic apparel to life, quite literally.
And our correspondent and this very show's former producer, David Pleasant, gets a run out in Rome to report on the renaissance of the city's iconic Olympic Park from 1960. Do stay tuned.
Australia's most populous city has far more going for it than its natural assets and good looks. The Monocle Travel Guide to Sydney bypasses the usual tourist haunts to unlock the harbour city's delights.
When it comes to architecture, the Sydney Opera House and the towering Harbour Bridge tend to grab all the attention. But turn 180 degrees from the water, and you'll find a city with many hidden architectural wonders, from historic sandstone edifices and glistening towers to modernist masterpieces and Victorian terraces, displaying a distinct Australian vernacular.
Looks can be deceiving, but in Sydney's case, they're only just the beginning. Watch our film celebrating the publication of the Monocle Travel Guide to Sydney. Head to the film section of monocle.com and just press play.
Biomimicry takes its design cues from the natural world, but there are researchers going even further into the minutiae of how organisms can help hone a product. At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a team known as the Tangible Media Group is sweating over a technology called Biologic.
The project involves introducing bacteria into textiles that behave in a certain way when exposed to moisture, and it's sportswear brands as well as scientists that are seeing potential in it.
To find out more, we spoke to Lining Yao, the designer responsible for the concept and creation of Biologic.
It's been an old concept to try to learn or mimic nature, natural behaviors or natural structures. However, if you think about nature has already been providing robust materials, why instead of just mimicking, why can't you just directly use them? That's kind of the whole concept, how you can shift from biomimicry to bio-derivation in this case. So it's deriving from nature directly. And the next step of bio-derivation would be bio-alternation. So not only you can get the functional material from nature and integrate it in man-made system, but also you can start to genetically engineer those natural organisms and customize or define their function that we desire even more for man-made structures. And I try to call these kind of interfaces or materials biohybrid.
Lining, tell me a little bit more about the specific applications of this kind of technology, both what you've been working on and other applications that it could potentially lead to in the future.
It's a huge area, and I think designers, scientists, engineers from different fields, we try to find applications that are also span different domains. For example, scientists are looking into how you can design the next generation medical devices, drug delivery system with such biohybrid. And for example, when we need to kind of deliver very specific particles to a specific location of the human body, you could use these kind of biohybrid robots, micro robots, to do this kind of transportation. And for me, as a designer or maybe as a person who is working across different fields, I am very interested in kind of integrating those high-tech biohybrid materials but into daily life. For example, in terms of biologic, we are looking into how we can design the future transformative garment. And indeed, we were collaborating with New Balance, and also we designed a dance piece with two ballet dancers from Boston Ballet Company. And we tried to inspire those dancers to think about new dance styles once they realized the living garments that they are wearing can actually just respond to their sweat, to their intensity of dancing, etc. But on the other side, we're also looking into how to design kind of the future biohybrid plants or biohybrid organisms with this synthesized material. For example, there was one example in our project video. We combined color changing function with the original shape changing function of this bacteria and developed a artificial flower that can change shape and also color at the same time. And you can imagine in the future, the plants or the cherry blossom will only blossom when the air condition is good rather than when the temperature and season are right.
And remember, it's not simply an intellectual pursuit. As we mentioned, the sportswear industry is keen to stay in step with these advances.
Athletic sportswear manufacturer New Balance is a sponsor of the Biologic Project. And I spoke to Chris Warsek, senior designer at the company, to find out why.
One of our probably best benefits of working with someone like the Media Lab is just exposing us to technologies and basically areas of interest that are totally outside of our current work spectrum. So I think also to credit the designers and the team members that work there at the Media Lab, I think their ability to kind of apply these technologies in ways that's very compelling and understandable. As soon as we saw some of the incredible media that Li Ning and Jaffe had put together regarding on how the biologic responds and works, it's hard to sort of turn a blind eye to that. But it's almost like the actual fact that it was biology was a bit secondary, but I think there's so much energy around the sort of biology as the new technology that it's certainly something that we want to keep an eye on and be aware of and, you know, in this case, sort of participate in a little bit to just understand what does that mean for the future of commercial products and does that have a role in the future?
And what does it mean? Because I know that they've developed some garments within MIT to kind of demonstrate the technology. But, you know, you work for New Balance, which is a sports shoe company. What specific application of this technology and similar types of technology do you envisage helping you develop your products in the future?
We do both footwear and apparel. I happen to work on the footwear team. And one of the things we realized kind of initially, the scale of apparel maybe lended itself a little bit better to the current state of the technology because the shoe is a relatively limited real estate in terms of actual dimensions of the materials. So that's kind of why we chose to sort of showcase it a little bit in the apparel side. But I think, you know, the long view as people like Wen mature this technology, I think the ways that she's been able to manipulate it and begin to think of how you can apply it to other different scales. And I think there's definitely some room there to imagine applications that are maybe more relevant to shoes. And certainly the interaction between sort of man-made materials and natural materials is something that was a pretty large hurdle. And there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of how do you get cells to stick on to different types of materials that are more commonly used in constructions of today's shoes and apparel.
Chris Warsek there, senior designer at New Balance, speaking to Henry Rhys Sheridan. And before that, Li Ning Yao of the Tangible Media Group at MIT. To finish the show, we bring you an item built on a report from the latest issue of Monocle magazine. As all eyes turn to Rio for the Olympic Games this summer, it's a fitting occasion to cast a glance at how some former hosts have managed their architectural legacy. Rome hosted the Games in 1960 and created a showpiece complex of apartment buildings that would act as a purpose-built Olympic village and new residential district after the athletes had dismounted their rostrums, packed their medals, and headed off home.
The notion of legacy and the positive urban impact of Olympic buildings is now standard. But how has Rome's Villaggio Olimpico fared over the past half century? Monocle's David Pleasant went to the village to find out.
As you veer east off northern Rome's ancient artery, the Via Flaminia, there's very little to indicate that you're approaching something of a modernist urban marvel, tucked away just south of the Tiber. The first clue to this neighbourhood's illustrious past is the grey concrete dome of engineer Pierluigi Nervi's Palazzetto dello Sport. Its turtle shell of a roof and intricate lattice interior was built to host the basketball tournament of the Games of the 17th Olympiad, which Rome hosted in the summer of 1960. Overseen by two of Italy's most renowned architects, Luigi Moretti and Adalberto Libera, it was designed to house 6,500 competitors and provide decent homes for state employees post-Olympics.
Proclamo l'apertura dei Giochi Olimpici di Roma, celebranti la 17ª Olimpiade dell'era moderna.
Arriving at the Villaggio today certainly lacks the fanfare that greeted the world's athletes half a century ago, when gleaming new structures flanked with flags and polished sculptures greeted athletes. Back then, a fleet of shiny, courtesy Lambretta mopeds was provided for the competitors' convenience. The verdant environs of the Villaggio Olimpico and its proximity to central Rome has attracted a community of creatives drawn to the modernist surroundings. Simona Salvo is an architectural conservationist who moved here 10 years ago.
The visual connections were one of the main principles of the urban plan. That is that the natural features of the place, considering the hill, the completely flat, in a way, setting of the place, and also the presence of the river, were put in high consideration by Luigi Moretti, who was the architect that designed the urban plan. But the visual connection is also very important at different scales and at different levels. That is, people walking through can always see through, for example, the pilotis level. Not only, mothers can see through the windows always directly their children playing in the playgrounds, in the gardens, but also, in a way, have a sense of privacy on one side, but also comfort by having the neighbors around. The neighborhood here is very well worked out, although not very much in an Italian way. So there's a sort of friction we were discussing the other day about between the fact that the architecture and the urban design of this place were a little bit ahead of the time in the 60s. The people are meeting them again. They appreciate them very much. It makes sense today much more than it did in the 60s.
Here at the Villaggio Olimpico, there's also a good handful of long-time residents going about their business in the village's mature piazzas and courtyards. Maria Ulaneo, who is in her 80s, is one such resident.
The neighbourhood was beautiful. It was full of flowers different to what you see around here now. And there used to be porters for each building back then. And you would see them carefully water the flowers every morning. It was like an Eden, so lovely. But then there was no money to pay the porters, and some 20 years after we moved, the old flats were sold off. Ours cost me 90 million lira, but we couldn't pay in cash, so we got what was then quite a pricey mortgage. But I'm so glad I did, as I'm very happy here. It's an Eden, and it doesn't feel like we're in Rome at all.
After a period of neglect in the 80s and 90s, regeneration was quickly spurred on by the arrival of Renzo Piano's much-acclaimed auditorium Parco della Musica in 2002 and Zaha Hadid's Maxi National Museum of 21st Century Art, which opened in 2010, scarcely 200 metres to the west. This, together with the Villaggio's modernist atmosphere, has attracted many architects and design professionals. It's easy to see why. Take Luigi Moretti's penchant for the ever-so-subtle angle that appears on the golden brick facades of flats and reinforced concrete pillars, giving those gently geometric convexes and concaves so synonymous with post-war Italian modernism. And how do these characteristics reflect on the everyday lives of residents today? No better way to find out than to visit Simona's lovingly restored apartment on Via Danimarca.
I actually did not renovate. I tried to conserve as much as possible of the finishes, of everything that made the setting of the 60s apartment. But at the same time, I just took away one wall that permitted me to live in the house in the living, between the living room and the kitchen, so to live together with my children as I was cooking or doing anything in the living spaces. So this is basically what I meant to do. The surface of the glazed surfaces is, in percentage, I think the highest I've ever met in an apartment. We're not talking about offices, we're talking about houses. And this was pretty innovative at the time. That's why a lot of people had a hard time fitting their big mahogany or wooden furniture into their houses with such big windows, because they had no wall against which place their furniture. So one of the things, and for example, the architects Moretti and Libera, in their drawings presenting the Olympic Village, they present a completely non-Italian setting with very low furniture, very 50s, but which did not belong to the social structure of the people that would have stepped in. The idea was, for, in my situation, which is rather typical, I had furniture from my grandparents. I had furniture from my family, also rather old, I would say antique. But at the same time, I had an ambition to stick in some things that belonged to me myself. So very contemporary design, also the need of sticking in new sofas, which I didn't have. So it's a little bit of a mixture which tells very much about my life, about my origins. But I think that in a way they match the house now. So a little bit by a little bit, and this is another thing, I didn't step in the house, it did everything at once. I grew into the house. And I think these houses need to be understood. This is one other key thing that I think should be considered. They have a quality which has to be discovered. So stepping in and wanting to do everything at once and like raising down, and of course you can reach very nice situations, but you don't meet the spirit of the place, which is a sort of idea, Italian idea of meeting the genius loci. I think these apartments sort of have a soul which in a way can be very interesting.
The Villaggio Olimpico seems to suit Simonetta Guidotti too. She is a regular newsreader on the Rai 2 10 p.m. news. Simonetta's light-filled apartment within the Crocetti-type blocks that are attributed to Adalberto Libera retains much from the original Olympic Village days. And how about the village's social mix? Is this a drawing point for Simonetta?
Yes, absolutely. We live in a normal place. We don't live in some sort of VIP ghetto. That would drive me totally mad. I have many TV colleagues that live here, news presenters that are much more famous than me. Like my colleague who reads the 11 p.m. news, she lives just in front of me. I think that if the council were to invest a little bit, the village would become even more desirable. There are some incredible corners here. The nature, the trees, the nuts that grow, the oranges. I don't need to buy lemons anymore. I just have to go out and pick them. I can walk my dogs. And best of all, I can find the ingredients for my herb arrosto to accompany roast meat. There's thyme, sage, and rosemary.
Sage, e questo è rosmarino.
5.5 decades have weathered and aged the once shiny utopian Villaggio Olimpico. But today, there is a palpable sense of community that is created not only by the diverse residents, but by the architecture and urban design themselves. The Villaggio has had its share of bumps and bruises, but at its core, it is still very much the village that retains the spirit of optimism that defined its athletic heyday. For Monocle, at the Villaggio Olimpico in Rome, I'm David Pleasant.
And you can read and see more on Rome's Olympic Village in David Pleasant's stellar report in the July-August summer issue of Monocle magazine, which is on all good newsstands now and available from monocle.com via subscription. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, ever patient as he is, the show's twinkly-eyed producer, sat opposite me, Henry Rhys-Sheridan, and to our helping hands this week, Faith Barker, Alice Tennant, Cy Villafuerte and Hannah Ritchie.
If you have any comments or queries, and feel free to drop me an email at hrs@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next week at the same time, and you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes, and please leave us a review on the latter.
Don't forget, you can read more in Monocle magazine's design pages each month, but for now, you've been listening to Section D on Monocle 24, and I'm Josh Fennett.
I'm Henry Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.